Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, your source for learning more about fly fishing in cold water, warm water, and salt water. Hello, I'm Roger Maves, your host for tonight's show. On this broadcast, we'll be featuring Kelly Gallup, and he'll be answering your most important questions on high-stick nymphing. The show will be 90 minutes in length, and we're broadcasting live over the Internet. If you'd like to ask Kelly a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. And while you're there, make sure to sign up to receive our announcements so you don't miss out on any of our future broadcasts. Just fill in your name and email address in the form on our homepage, and we'll keep you informed. This broadcast is being recorded and will be available for playback on our website within about 48 hours after the show ends. So if you have to leave early, you can return to the website at your convenience and listen to the broadcast at any time. The content of this broadcast is copyrighted and is the property of the Knowledge Group, Inc., doing business as Ask About Fly Fishing. Recordings or transcriptions of this program cannot be distributed or sold in any form. When we return, we'll be talking with Kelly Gallup about high-stick nymphing. At flyfishtv.com, all of Kelly Gallup's DVDs and streamed videos are available. Nymphing by the numbers and high-sticking and reading water will take your angling skills to a new level. Kelly's game-changing streamer fishing and tying titles will help you find the biggest fish in your home waters. In all, you'll find 8 different productions Kelly hosts at flyfishtv.com. Some other great anglers with DVDs and streamed videos on the site are Mike Lawson, Davey Wanton, Terry and Wendy Gunn, Denny Rickards, Jim Teeny, and many more, all available at flyfishtv.com. Check out flyfishtv.com for any of Kelly's titles. Before we introduce Kelly, we'd like to let you know about the great gifts we have to give away tonight. For our drawing tonight, we'll be giving away a one-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers and a one-year subscription to the Fly Fishing and Tying Journal. So you have 2 chances to win tonight in our drawing. Now, if you haven't registered yet for the drawing, you can do so now. Just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and look for the link under Kelly's section that says click here to register for our drawing. Click on that link and fill out the form, and we'll announce the winners at the end of the show. We will also be giving away a copy of Kelly's DVD, High Sticking and Reading Water, produced by Flyfish TV. So here's how you can win Kelly's DVD. You must be the first person to answer the question we ask at the end of the show. The question will be about something we talked about during the show, and you must submit your answer, along with your name and location, using the text box on our homepage. So listen closely and use your best typing skills, and maybe you'll win Kelly's DVD, High Sticking and Reading Water. Our guest tonight is Kelly Gallup. Kelly started his fly fishing career at the age of 13, tying flies for the local tackle shop. Kelly has over 40 nationally recognized fly patterns, and he started guiding at the age of 16 and is still guiding to this day some 30-plus years later. Kelly knows how to catch trophy trout, especially with streamers, but not in the way you might think. You have to listen in to our show on streamers to find out about his techniques and strategies. But Kelly's also written books about other subjects, and has been published in every major fly fishing periodical in the country. Kelly is also one of the hosts of Flyfish TV on the Outdoor Life channel. He owned and operated the Troutsman Fly Shop in northern Michigan from 1981 to 2002, and in the spring of 2002, he sold the Troutsman and moved to Montana, where he bought the Slide-In Lodge on the Madison River. Kelly has written 2 books on modern streamers for trophy trout and cripples and spinners. Kelly has been published throughout the country and has been editor for Fly Fisherman magazine and also one of the hosts on Fly Fish TV. In 2004, Kelly was nominated and received the Living Legend Award by the Federation of Fly Fishers. Kelly, welcome back to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio.
Thanks, Raj. Glad to be back.
Yeah, good to have you. And I watched your DVD today, and, you know, I actually learned a few things.
Good to hear it.
That's because
I went and got a haircut just for this event.
Oh, you did? Yeah, that's good. Yeah. I can tell. Yeah.
I think it's because I've been told I've got a face for radio. So.
Yeah. <That's good. laughs> Me too. I've got a head of hair for radio. That's what I got. So it's got a lot of questions here on high stick nymphing, and of course we're going to wrap that with the reading water as well here, and follow. Along with your DVD. Of course, it's always nice to have the DVD and look at the water and what you're looking at, and that makes all the difference in the world to learn some of these things. But let's try to do our best and help people out and see if we can't make them better fishermen today and tonight. And Let's just dive right in. So high stick nymphing, it's been around for a long time. Rich Bauer in Pennsylvania asks, you know, we've heard so much about European nymphing, your own nymphing, Czech nymphing, that kind of thing, and also Gilbert in Johannesburg, South Africa wrote in asking the same kind of question. So what's the difference between high sticking and the Euro nymphing techniques like Czech and French and so forth?
Well, the real difference, they're kind of the same thing. It's more about the placement of the fly and the lack of the indicator. And, you know, and a lot of this has to do with competition fishing. You know, European, you're still going to be holding your rod. High sticking simply means you're holding your line off the water. You're generally fishing pretty tight. But in competition fishing, you can't use indicators and you can't use lead. And so what Czechin and French and the different guys, it's just, you know, who does what where is all it is. But the difference is the point fly is generally your weight. So instead of having a split shot and an indicator, your weight has to be incorporated into your fly. And so, and then you aren't able to use indicator proper. You can use different colored line, but you can't use an indicator. So they're really, the angle of the rod is high sticking. That's what the whole, how you're doing it. You're still doing that when you're checking. Remember, you're completely doing it when you're checking, check nymphing or any of the, not so much the French, because a lot of the times that's associated with leaving your line on the water. But for the most part, it means that you're holding your rod high and feeling more than seeing. So it's eliminating, in the European style, it's eliminating your indicator and your split shot, and that's really only the difference.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I know that the Czech definitely use some, like you say, different heavyweight flies that are.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they put their fly. That's their, because you can't put a split shot on. And
yeah.
So, and you know, and really, and you can't use an indicator. So, and that's basically how people have learned to fish in the last 15 years with indicators. And so it's
right.
Just basically two different styles.
Right, right. So, let's talk, we'll dive into here a little later about presentation and so forth and the whys and the wherefores for high sticking. But let's talk about, equipment first. There's quite a few questions about that. Jim in White Plains, New York, want to know about length, weight, and action of the rod you recommend. And as did Doug McLean in Calgary, wanting to know, you know, is there something special you use for high stick nymphing?
Well, you know, what I do, Roger, is I design those rods twofold, really. It's the European rods are really generally longer than the ones we use here and much lighter. They'll go down to 2 and 3 weights frequently. But I kind of wanted to have one in between because I don't particularly care for the really long rods. I personally like a 10-foot rod. My favorite is the 10-foot 4-weight. Because there's enough rod there to handle any fish. I mean, in my video, you see where I get that big brown on the streamer. I was nymphing, but he kept eating my fish, so I threw a streamer at him. And he got his payback. He stuck a number 4 saltwater hook through my back arm, or the back hook through my arm. But anyway, the 10-foot rods, I mean, the 10-4s, 10-5s, are plenty of rod for any application, you know, for almost anything, because you don't fish that deep. And so I prefer to have that rod. And again, back to the high sticking or checking, it's all about your rod angle and your line angle into the water. So the longer the tool is to keep your line off the water, the more efficiently you're going to, you know, fish your water. And it's about, you know, optimizing movement. So you're not having to move a lot and you know, do a lot of mending and things like that. And if you do, the rod is the thing. It's the tool that helps you do it. And so personally, I like the 10-footers. You know, there's a lot of, in the Europeans, there's a lot of 11s. You know, it just, to me, it's just a little bit more than I need for most of the water I fish here back in the States.
Now, you said you kind of inferred that you designed the rod. So was this some – did you work with the company on designing the rod?
I'm sorry. I kind of I'm one and the same with it. Yeah, for, I work for St. Croix, and I designed the high stick. You know, it's called high sticking, but the rod is called the high stick drifter.
Oh, okay.
It's a series of nymphing rods. We've got a 9.5 four weight, a 10-4, and a 10-5. And I designed those rods specifically for fishing a two-fly system. And the reason I make them a little quicker than the standard European rods is that most American anglers fish indicators. And so whenever you put a two-fly, a split shot, and then the drag of the indicator, and they're basically a parabolic flex, meaning they flex equally from head to toe. It's just got a slightly quicker tip, and that's basically twofold. One, to turn over the indicator, but also just so it makes it a little quicker on your hook set. And those, there's only three in that series because I just don't think you need more than that.
Yeah, yeah. But in lieu of one of those, specifically designed rods for high sticking,
mm-hmm.
nymphing. So your next best bet would be something like the longest, 10-foot-4, 10-foot-5, something like that.
Sure. Yeah, I mean the difference is that when you, because what I fish most, I don't fish indicators very often. I mean, I did it my high sticking because I wanted to show people different ways to do it, but we mostly are going by feel. And so any nine, even 9-footers, I mean, I'm just trying to make the, when I made those rods, want to make the best rod for what we do.
Right.
But any 9 or 10 foot, I'd be careful getting above a 5 weight with most rods, just because you're using light tippet and you're setting a hook. But, when you get into the 6 weights, you'll see people wanting the 6 weights, more in spring and dirty water or, in areas like that where you're having to use more weight because you got deeper water, dirty water, whatever, using bigger flies, which we'll get to in the flies. I don't really believe that, by the way, using big flies. But if you are, that's the rod. Then it won't matter. I mean, we did it for a long time without specialized rods. So just,
but that extra foot can make the difference a lot of times, can it, as far as reach?
It's a giant difference. It truly is. And what the amazing thing is that it's the difference is in the arm saving. I mean, you have a mechanical advantage. You have your line off the water, and so when you're high sticking, your rod's up in the air a foot higher than, you've got line control to manipulate your drift. And it is a big difference.
And I noticed in the DVD, too, you were talking about, the leverage with the extra foot, too, of
mm-hmm.
roll casting easier.
For all practical purposes, you shouldn't be casting a two-fly rig anyway. You should be roll casting. And when we talk about presentation, we'll talk about that. I mean, fishing closer and tighter to you and, visualizing your fish instead of casting it way out there and just hoping. And so the leverage part is, it's just much easier to roll cast a 10-foot rod and get the fly back in the water. And the reason I say you shouldn't be casting is that you put two flies, a split shot, an indicator, and you start false casting, you are going to be a macrame expert. It's going to be a disaster sooner or later.
Yeah.
The more time that flies in the water, the more you're fishing anyway. So.
Right. Right. Yeah. No, I've been there many times. I think we all have.
Yeah.
So, Jim Kohler in New York wrote in and asked about switch rods. He said, "Is it possible to use one for this, or is it productive, or does it make any sense?"
That's a common question, not only with nymphs but with streamers, and it's possible to use anything. I don't personally like most of the switches. They're really not designed. You can do anything. I get this asked about streamers, too. You can do anything, but the rod is designed to cast a longer line and to passively swing the fly and not to set the hook quickly. It's designed to pick your rod up and set the hook like you do when you're doing a steelhead swing. And so, yes, you could use it, but it's more rod. They're generally heavier weight. Even if they're 6, they're a heavier rod because they're designed to throw a skagit, some kind of head. And so they're really designed to do their own job. And so, yes, you could use it, but when you start breaking down how close you're fishing, and especially when you start getting the butt section or the fighting butts on the switches, I don't think they're effective. They're heavier. They're soft enough to do the job, and yeah, they'll cast it, but I don't think they are as efficient fishing close. And again, remember, the rod is not designed to fish close. A switch rod is designed to spay cast, you know, the single spay or whatever spay you do, and throw a line 40, 60, 80 feet and swing a fly.
Yeah.
Well, that tool is not designed to roll cast and fish 20 feet in front of you or 10 feet in front of you. So, yes, you can, but I don't think it's as efficient as a rod. I actually don't think it's as good in some respects as a 9-foot would be. But that's just, you know, a lot of people do it. A lot of people do use them.
Yeah.
And especially when they're fish, especially when they're nymph fishing steelhead, a lot of people use them. And frankly, so did I when I was in the Great Lakes. I had one. I actually designed a switch rod in the 80s. It was with Powell, and that we used basically to nymph fish for steelhead. And then they were pretty nice because we were using more weight. Frequently, they'd be using like 3 number 7 split shot. The runs were short and fast, and so we had to have a lot of weight. And there they had a very good mechanical advantage. But for generally trout fishing, I would say I don't like them.
Yeah. What about Tenkara rods? They're long and light.
Yeah, well, I'm public radio. I can't really tell you what I think. But I think I said once, I think they're dumber than buying a cat. But that got me in a lot of trouble. You know, Tenkara, they have their, if I'm up in a mountain stream in Japan, I think they're great. But I just, you know, personally, and this is totally personal, don't everybody call me and tell me to hate me because I don't fish Tenkara. I don't like having to drop my rod. I don't like having to grab my leader to land my fish. I like the idea. I mean, I think they'd be great if you were in a boat and you didn't have to do anything. But I personally don't have any...
Yeah.
Desire to fish. I mean, I don't have anything against it, obviously. I don't like
to. Doesn't fit your style and methods.
No, and I don't like dropping my rod to chase my fish, so that's not part of my MO.
Okay. Question about, let's see, Dan from Illinois says, I'm new to nymph fishing. What is a good line weight to start with, and should it be floating or sinking?
Basically, at this point, all is floating. There was a time, and actually that's where sink tips came from. People don't realize, they think that some way they were made to swing. They actually were designed to do what's called the Brooks style of, the Brooks method of nymphing was using a sinking line, as opposed to using split shot. And people start realizing it's a lot easier to have a short head and then a floating portion that you can control. And that's where they kind of came from. But the floating line, and for all checking or anything like that, it's always, a floating line. And for me, I prefer the 4 weights. I think probably all around a 5 weight would be the better of the starting because it's thicker and it's going to pick up the line, or excuse me, the flies and the lead and the indicator easier than a 4 weight will. You know, it's just a bigger bulk and it's going to turn over easier. And so I would say as a starter, I would be on the 5 weights. And again, if he's fresh and he's not dedicated to it, he could take a medium action 9-foot 5-weight, which would be a very versatile rod, and it would be a good for getting started in all, you know, his dries, small streamers, and nymphing.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and then Walt Cole continued the conversation here. He's from California. He said, can you describe your high stick setup from the end of the fly line to the fly? So your terminal tackle, you know, leader, tippet, so forth.
Mm-hmm.
How do you rig that up?
You know, I do mine pretty a lot different than I personally am. I do what's called drop shotting. I don't fish indicators, and I fish colored butt section. And so I build my own leaders and my butt section. And anybody that wants to call in, and I'll show them my diagrams. But basically what I use, and I have a step-down program I start people with here, it's where we take 3 different colors of fly line. It's actually yellow, red, yellow, and we put 13-weight cord fly line, and it's getting confusing, I understand that. You just pull this piece of fly line off, and you put it down, you put it in 2 different places on the butt section, and so you can see it. It's kind of not really an indicator. It's not floating, it sinks, but you can see it. And that's kind of the first way we do it. But what I do personally is I use 3 foot of 12 pounds yellow gold strand, it's called. It's kind of a yellow color. So I use 3, sometimes 4, not very often, usually 3 foot of 12 pound gold strand. And then I use 4 to 5 foot of 3X fluorocarbon. And then there's a blood knot. And then everything below that is 4X, for the, generally speaking. I mean, you go up or down, obviously. But, so then I go 16 inches to my fly, where I connect those two. Right, so I go 16 inches from the 3X with 4X. I tie another blood knot, then I drop another 16 inches. So you'll have 3 knots in that system. The very bottom, when I go eye to eye to the fly, and then I drop a 6-inch tag below that, which is what I connect my lead to.
Uh-huh.
And we'll, and I'll, and so, and above that, there's a dropper loop. So there's, at the very point, the point, and by the way, that's a confusing thing with people. They ask, you know, which one's the point? Is it the upper fly or the lower fly? The point is, in the best way I've ever heard described, the point of the arrow is the furthest thing away from you. And it's the same with your fly rig. Your last fly is your point fly. And so the point fly has a, the line coming into the eye, has another piece of line going out of the eye, which is what I connect my lead to. 16 inches above that, there's a blood knot with a 4-inch dropper loop, which is my other fly, and that's the whole system.
Mm-hmm. And you said, and so, you said you had diagrams available for folks?
Yeah, I've got you can call the shop or whatever, and or email me, and they're all scanned. But the other thing you can do, if you don't want to do that, if say you're going to use your indicator fishing still, but you still want to use this system, if you take a 7.5 foot, just standard extruded leader, the last 32 inches roughly of your leader is always tippet, the same size. So essentially you get the same thing, and then you just build off of that. So add your 16 inches, so you take a 3X leader. And remember, when you're building these leaders, when you're nymph fishing, the key is to get to bottom as quick as you can with as little weight, so everything's moving with the current and not, you're not slowing things down, and you feel bottom or you see the touch. And so the lighter that tippet is, the quicker it sinks to bottom. And so the idea is to have a very short buck section and then virtually everything else. I mean, there's, I know guys that fish straight butt section 3 foot and everything is tippet from there on out. So, but just remember, the lighter your tippet is, the quicker your descent. So you're going to get down quicker with less weight.
Okay.
And I know that's complicated, but it's just basically take a 7.5 footer and add 2 foot to the end of it, and you'll go.
Mm-hmm. I hope that answers your question, Bill, in Pennsylvania. So, and if you do, you can call Kelly at the shop and get the diagram. He was asking about building your own leaders and what's your formula.
Mm-hmm.
So we addressed that pretty specifically. Good. Okay, let's talk. Well, let me see what I've got online here. Okay, Dante, we kind of talked about rods and switch rods.
And you baited me into Tenkara.
I didn't know what your answer was going to be, actually. I didn't know. I know Daniel well, and he lives in Boulder here in Colorado, so hopefully he'll take it gracefully.
It's got a huge following. I've got a bunch of buddies to do it, tons of
them. Sure, yeah. Yeah, and we all have our own preferences, so no worries. Dante also asked, if you had an old drift boat and wanted to get a new one, would you get a drift boat or would you get a raft with a fishing frame to explore new waters?
It depends on where I'm fishing. If rafts are more durable, they're easier to fish out of in the respect that you don't have to be a great oarsman. You can bash into rocks. You don't get stuck as often, but they're not as user-friendly from the interior aspect. When fishing from a raft, it's I have a raft as well, but it's just the creature comforts in a hardboard I much prefer.
Yeah.
I like the storage. I like the flat decks. Your line's not getting caught between the decks and the tubes. But I have both. It just depends on if I have to drag my boat a long ways or if I'm solely whitewater or a lot of boulder water. They're so much better because you just don't bash into. You can hit a rock wide open. It really just doesn't do much.
You know, like there's the Arkansas by me here in Colorado, and I won't take my hard boat down that because it's just too risky and it's too hard to repair them. You know, I mean.
And it's just, you know, that's why they make them both. And if I'm on the North Platte, or I wouldn't on a flat water, anything that's flat, I don't like them, but just because of the creature comforts. But as soon as I start getting broken water, I've got mine and I've got the full fishing frame and it's fine. I just, right tool for the right job.
Right, right.
That's why everybody should have both.
Yeah.
To tell your wife, I heard this and it's true, you should have two boats.
That's what I just was going to say. I said, not all wives will go along.
I know wives that are the ones that buy them.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
It does work
but
that way,
their husband
too.
Don't fish.
And he also asked about a second edition to your streamer book. Are you working on another streamer book?
Yep, it's almost done. It's at the editor, Greg Thomas, editor of Fly Rod and Reels, the editor, and we should have final and go to print. We should go to float in the pages within the month. And I'm out, you know, I've been saying that for a year, but it's in the process. I'm hoping that it's going to be out by May.
Okay. Okay. I'd like to continue with what's happening in your fly fishing world, but let me do a quick commercial here and then we'll be right back. Okay.
Okay.
Housatonic River Outfitters offers the finest in fly fishing products in Connecticut and fly fishing guides on the Housatonic, Farmington, and other waters. You have the option of wade fishing trips or drifting the river with their guides. In addition to the spectacular trout fishing, they offer guided fly fishing trips and spin fishing trips for warm water species. Please tour their website at www.dryflies.com to view the fishing products and guide services they offer in Connecticut and Massachusetts. They were the first fly shop in Connecticut to offer drift boat guide services and have the largest established guide service in New England. To learn more about Housatonic River Outfitters, visit www.dryflies.com. That's www.dryflies.com. If you're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, we're talking with Kelly Gallup about high stick nymphing. If you'd like to ask Kelly a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. Okay, Kelly, tell us more about what's been happening. A new book coming out, and how is it up there in Montana?
It's nice and cold. It's a good thing about it. The cold is a good thing. It cleanses everything, and it keeps the people away. And that's what keeps Montana. It's a nice cleaning. And we're talking about the new book coming out, and I'll do a quick shout out to everybody. I've told people this for 2 years. I'm doing a gallery, so anybody that sends a picture, a good pitch, they got to be quality picture, obviously, but I'm putting everybody. I've got about 150 pictures right now that from people I don't know at all, and I'm putting them in the book just because I think it'd be fun. So if anybody sends me their picture and tells me I can use it, if I can use it, I will. But
okay, does it have to have a fish with a streamer in its mouth or what?
Well, unless their significant other is very attractive, yes. But I've currently got everything from peacock, garp, cuda, doesn't matter the species, lots of bass stuff. I got a catfish. I mean, it's been really fun because there's quite a following with it, and that's been a lot of fun. But other than that, it's just been the show circuit all winter.
You should get a picture from Jeff Currier of the golden Dorado he caught down there.
I do have a Dorado. I don't know if it's him. It's not Jeff. I should call him. You're right. I think O'Keefe's got one. Of course, that's all he does is go around fishing, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, fishing bum, yeah.
Yeah. Photo.
And tell people about your business there in Montana so that they know what you do up there.
Well, it's a fly fishing lodge, fly shop, obviously. We've got an online store. Everything's accessible through slidein.com. The shops, we're here 8 to 5 days a week in the winter. We're not actually open. We just do the phone and the internet business in the winter. Then come May through November, you know, guiding, fly shop, lodging, schools. We've got a lot of schools coming up this year. Just generally fun stuff.
Right. And the website is slidein.com, right?
Yep. That'll get you to any of the anything on there. And anybody can, like I said, anybody can send in requests, any of the diagrams or anything like that. We'll send you one, no charge.
Okay, okay. I have some more questions coming in. Here's kind of an unusual one. How do you name your flies? Some have unusual names.
misguided childhood. that started out as a joke with the first fly ever was called the Stacked Blonde. And
yeah.
It was actually Joe Brooks. I was trying to tie Joe Brooks' fly called the Platinum Blonde. Joe Brooks has always been my hero, and I just couldn't do it well, and I put it on a keel hook. Actually, I saw another guy do a fly like that, Walt Grau, and I started stacking hair in a different, just a little different, trying to make it big like Brooks's was, and obviously it should be a Stacked Blonde because it was on a keel hook, and they told me that would never work. Not the fly, but the name, and they, Ray Schmidt, were wrong.
So that created a trend, huh?
Oh, my God. It's like an avalanche. So sometimes not good either. Sometimes I take a lot of heat for it. I take heat for other people's flies.
Yeah.
If I can get the royalty for their fly, I'll take the heat. Otherwise, I won't.
Yeah, there you go. Danny in Clarksville, Arkansas, wanted to know, he said, is a 10-foot rod a light or medium action rod?
Light.
Light.
I guess by today, you know, in the European styles, they're light. They're much softer action. Mine's kind of a medium. It's kind of a medium action. And the key to these, when you start testing these rods, these longer rods, don't just go into the shop and shake it. You have to hold a really firm grip, and you really won't know, even on the light Euro rods, you'll pick them up and you'll shake them and you'll say, oh, that thing's just a noodle. But you really have to put a line on one to see how it, because it'll start a harmonic motion. If you start shaking, it'll just start going up and down, and you won't have any idea what it's doing. So it really behooves you to find some place where you can take it out and actually cast with the line. But generally speaking, when you're talking light line, high sticking, Euro checking, whatever, you light tip it. And so you can't have a super fast rod until you don't have any shock absorption. So you're setting the hook quick, and you need a rod that's medium to soft all the way through.
Okay. Another online question here. David in Phillipsburg says, and you were talking about tippet diameter before, about sink speed, and he's asking, does tippet size diameter make a difference with clean natural drift when nymphing?
Enormous.
Okay.
Was there more to the question? I'm sorry.
Yeah, and then he went on to say, what size would you recommend? So.
Okay. Yeah, that's what I was saying. The lighter the tippet, the quicker the descent. And that's the key to really being a good angler, a good nymph angler, is that the lighter, the quicker you get to bottom, the faster you get to bottom, so the smaller the diameter, so, you know, 5X is going to sink faster than 3X. And the faster it gets down, and you don't want it dragging the bottom, you want it to touch the bottom, and the more naturally that floats, so that if it goes with exactly the same speed the other bugs are, exactly the speed of the current, the more natural it's going to look. The smaller the diameter the tippet, the less lead it's going to take to do that, and you will still feel the bottom, and that's the difference. Getting there quickly, feeling it and touching without it dragging. You don't want it to stop intermittently through the water. You know, if you're dragging bottom, your fly is hanging there doing nothing, which nothing can do in moving water. And then you give it a pull. Of course, then it goes up and down, so you're really not effectively getting a natural drift.
Okay. Okay. So let's continue on talking about flies in this next section. And Doug McLean in Calgary wrote in and several questions. He said, want to know tips on favorite multi-fly rigs, top types of flies for high-stick nymphing, tying tips for flies for high-sticking nymphing. So
okay.
A bunch of questions there. But
that's good, though. They're very relative. And I'm going to go backwards just a second into the, you know, my personal belief is that fish feed in level to 6-inch windows above their head. They almost never feed below their head. So that's something to keep in mind here. And in lakes, it's the same. You know, they don't drop below. What creates a fish, what creates the impetus for the fish to start feeding in the first place is always biomass. All right? And so it starts at a certain time of day, and it's different throughout the season, obviously. But the movement of the natural insect from the bottom to the top, that biomass movement is the trigger to get the fish starting feeding. So when we were talking about getting to the bottom quickly, you want the fly in the right place. So we'll get to that, I hope, later if we have time. But as far as the multi-rig flies, the first thing I would say is I don't really have a favorite fly. If I had one the rest of my life, it would be a golden hairsear. And then I'd have to have a caddis larva of some sort. But, and then I'd have to have a midge, and I'd have to own a midge. But if I had one, it would be that. But the key here is to remember the fly you're trying to – I don't think you have to be that specific to the fly. If the fly is in the right place, they're going to eat it. And I say this in all my seminars. You can fish the wrong fly right and catch fish, but you can't fish the right fly wrong. Meaning, if it's in the wrong depth, it's not going to be the right fly. So the first thing I do is set up to the where my flies are where they belong. And there's a couple things about my favorite multi-flies and the types of flies. It's the first, just a couple quick sidebar. I never fish weighted flies. I know that's going to get asked in here somewhere.
Yeah, that's the next question.
weighted nymphs versus unweighted, I get it. Yeah. 10 times a week at least. I never weight the flies. Now that's one distinction between high sticking and Euro fishing. The first question we had from Rich, what's the difference? And the difference is that you use a weighted fly on the bottom and you're not allowed to use split shot. So you have a heavily weighted fly on the bottom, but then generally you can fish a cast of fly, you can fish three flies. So my theory is that the bottom fly is virtually worthless if the fish doesn't feed below his head and you're using it as your anchor, that's what you call it when you fish a check, and that one goes to bottom, it's always below the fish's head. The only chance the fish gets to see it is when you give it a pop and it comes up in the water column, which isn't very natural. I personally fish my leader below my flies, which isn't, by the way, isn't legal in all places. Some places you can't do it. If you can't, then I put it between them. But the idea of fishing a two-fly rig is not to make Kelly more money when you're at the shop because you buy twice as many flies. The idea is to figure out what level your fish are feeding in. And so the idea there is the two-fly rig is to have the right fly in the right zone. So my favorite one would be the fish and fly they're eating. But the types of flies would be generally when you associate the bottom, that's where the flies start first. They start on the bottom and they migrate through the water column. So you take a fly that would be most accurate to the fly closest to the bottom. So that's going to be a nymph like a hare's ear or a pheasant tail. And then you're going to have, above that, you're going to have a fly that would be in a pupation state or emergent state, which would be your mayfly and your caddis or your pupating midges. So you get the flies in the right zone first. Then the fly's not quite so critical because they'll eat the wrong fly if it's where it belongs. And the next thing I would say to that is that I almost never fish a beadhead. Beadhead is not a species. It's something Roman Mauser did for competitive grayling fishing. Roman is an incredible angler, one of the best I've ever seen. And he did it, and he slid him down as leader. And it became this thing in the U.S. especially where virtually every fly has to have a beadhead. But if you think about it, no insect goes down in the water column. So if you're using the fly under hopper dropper for weight, that's one thing. But to put it in your system, I don't use beadheads. I mean, virtually never when I'm nymphing. If I've got too many, if they're in my bin, I'll take them, yes. But if I'm tying my own, you won't find hardly any, and you won't find any weighted flies. I let the lead do the weighting, and that is back to the other question about them that was online a second ago about is the fly moving freely. The lighter that fly is, the more it's moved freely in the water column. So what I do is I place the flies properly, and the beadhead, and by the way, just a side note on that beadhead thing, beadheads are reflective, And remember, nothing in nature reflects light without sunlight. So if you have a cloudy day, lose those bead heads. You'll be a whitefish god. Just lose the shine. And on carrying through with that shine thought, anytime you have reflection on a fly, so we're back to my favorite fly type thing, if you have a reflection on the fly, like a flashback or a crystal serendipity style fly or something that's really flashy, remember that that flash is supposed to represent the ectoskeleton, the gaseous bubble in the ectoskeleton, right? It's supposed to be a reflection of that thing. That reflection, because you don't get that on the bottom. They only get a reflection as they start to emerge. So anytime you see flash or crystal, it should be in the upper fly. Does that make sense? So,
yep.
So you place your flies according not only to the type, but if you're flashbacking or you're crystal fishing, make sure it's higher in the water column. And that, because that's the only time the fish is going to see it. So my
let me clarify that. So we've got a two fly rig, and where did you say you put the weight?
Now I personally, it's called drop shotting. It's the same as check nymphing, where the bottom fly is the heaviest thing, but I'm using lead. So I have a 6-inch tag off the bottom fly, and that's what I attach my. So I've got a piece of 5X that comes out of the bottom fly. I use 5X so because it never gets. I never lose a fly. And that keeps, and there's more to it than that. And so that, the fly's, like, when it's drifting at an angle, it's about 4 inches off the bottom. And that's where the fish are feeding, at their eye level or above. So that gets that fly directly where the fish is. The fly above that is going to be, because it's on a 4-inch dropper, 16 inches above that, it's going to be roughly a foot above that fish. You know, it could be, it depends on your angle, it could be 6 to 8 inches, maybe a foot. And I'm identifying which level the fish are feeding in.
And so that you've got that 5X tag at the bottom just has a split shot on it. Then you've got a fly, and then you've got a fly above that. And
correct.
The top fly is emerging fly, and the bottom fly is your nymph. Yeah.
Yeah, and you'll see a lot of people running the double hairs there, whatever. So you basically just have two flies. I guess you're creating your own hatch, but you're not learning anything. You're not establishing it. The fish moved above you. You know, so you're fishing along. You're doing really well. It's 9 o'clock in the morning, catching the heck out of the fish. Now it's 10 o'clock, and then they went off the bite. Now they just moved up the water column. They start on the bottom, and they move to the top and to the point where you see them start eating dries. Happens every day. Happens every river all over the world. There's no difference.
Now, a lot of people will do the reverse of what you described, and they'll have two flies and the weight above the top fly. And then that kind of reverses the whole layout, doesn't it?
It does, and there's a couple things. That's the most common system there is for sure, and it's almost always done. You'll never see somebody checking or a vesta. You would never do it. There's a couple inherent problems with it. It's the least tangles. It's the best way to start. It's not bad from a boat. On foot, but I want you to just think of something. The lead being the heaviest element, right? That's the slowest part of this equation. So your lead's above your flies. So now your flies are below both pieces of lead, or both flies are below your lead, excuse me. And you're probably using an indicator above it. So the flies are below, and they're the first thing the fish sees. The fish takes the fly. If he doesn't take it and run to the side, you're never going to know you had a hit. I mean, it's the least efficient for sure. And a simple way to stop, and you also have both flies in one water column for all practical purposes. In that case, if you're gonna, your bottom fly should, in theory, be the one that's higher than your,
right,
the upper fly or the lead, and then the fly is, you know, it's gonna be the closest to the lead, the first one. The bottom one, the point fly, would be up above it.
Right.
And back to that beadhead thing. You just think where you want your flies and don't fight your own system. You know, don't put, if you want that back fly to be higher, if you're doing lead fly, say you're using you got a caddis larva and a pupa, you wouldn't put beads on the bottom one because you're going to have them the same level. So just constantly think where your lead is and where your flies are in relation to the lead. And then, you know, a lot of times you see people running a double nymph rig, and they got two bead head flies on. Well, they're basically fishing the same water zone. They're not doing anything. It catches fish. I did it for years. I mean, I started
they're
out.
They're not learning anything about what they're eating or where they are. Yeah.
Yeah, and that's the whole key is the fish, they follow the biomass. You know, they just think about it's a migration. It starts from the bottom and comes up. You should be following that with it. And with that dropper loop system I was talking about with how I put the lead on the bottom, my fly, and then above it, I got 60 inches, I got a 4-inch dropper loop. You can actually slide that up. You can take it up to skitter on the surface and still nymph fish. You can move it as far up and down as you want. It's on a sliding dropper. It's just a perfection loop, you know, wrapped around your leader and tightened up. But the key is you can establish what water column those fish are feeding in. And it's generally less than a 2-foot window. Because nymphs don't start in really deep water. They're generally less than 4 foot of water. So you get 6 inches off the bottom to start your feeding zone. And then they just follow that migration up. Well, and by the time they're 2 foot off the bottom, it's a mix of dry fly feeding and, you know, things, dry flies and right in the film. So, for all practical purposes, it's about time to switch over to the dry fly anyway.
Yeah,
but,
yeah.
You know, it allows you to learn what's, and frankly, after a couple seasons of doing that and knowing what it is, or actually a couple days, you walk down to the river, it's 11 o'clock, and you go, the fish are all in the mid-level. You don't have to waste all your time going through that whole, process. That being said, there's always fish in all levels. I mean, they don't all just do it all at once, but the majority of them do. That's why you see pods of fish suddenly appear in front of you. You know, I haven't seen a fish rise all, oh, there they are, and then they're all there, right?
Yeah.
It's because they followed the biomass.
Yeah.
That's all there is to it.
Very good.
I never weight my flies.
Mm-hmm.
I always let the lead do that.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I think a lot of us are going to, think about that a lot more because then again, if somebody put the lead in between the flies, then that changes the whole configuration.
Yeah.
You really have to be conscious of what you're doing here.
And that's my second favorite way to do it. If I'm not doing drop shot, I do fly, lead, fly. Because again, the point fly is the lowest. That's the one closest to your lead. So that's going to be my larva or my nymph, my standard hare's ear pheasant tail. And then the one above that, I also do a dropper loop on that, by the way. But you can do it eye to eye, however you want. The one above that's going to be in a different water column. And so that's going to, obviously in that case, you just put your pupating fly or your emergent fly on that upper piece.
Mm-hmm.
Now you're fishing two levels. It's virtually a tangle-free system. It's really simple.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Let me take a quick break here, Kelly, and I'll be right back, and we'll continue the conversation. Front Range Anglers, a full-service fly shop located in Boulder, Colorado, provides premium tackle and comprehensive instruction and guide services to fly fishers across the country. In business for over 31 years and with a staff that averages 20 years of experience, they will give you the straight story on gear, places to fish, flies, and techniques. They publish a monthly newsletter that is one of the most insightful and informative electronic magazines in the industry. Find out more about this premier shop by logging on to their website at www.frontrangeanglers.com. That's www.frontrangeanglers.com. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We're talking with Kelly Gallup about high stick nymphing. If you'd like to ask Kelly a question, go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. Receive it immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. Okay. So, yeah, that was the next question was weighted nymphs versus unweighted from Doug over in Vancouver Island. And so I think we've answered his question about that.
I honestly think that's the most frequent question I get.
Yeah, it's asked a lot because it's, and then you look at the check nymphing, and it's just the reverse. It's total weight of fly.
But it's the thing to remember with that is that with check nymphing, is they're not running a two-fly rig. They're almost always running 3 to 5. And so they get to cover their double levels, their 2 or 3 levels, and still have that thing on the bottom that's their constant. And we'll get to that in the technique thing, I'm sure, about line stuff, but presentation, but we'll go through that in a minute.
Yeah. Yeah, a couple more things on flies here. Questions, Brian in San Diego. He says, do you find hot spots useful on your flies when high sticking?
You know, I do. It depends on the style, and I find it more effective on bigger flies, say a size 14 and bigger. Incredibly effective on stonefly nymphs, and I think that's just basically the fact that they're all of them have a two-tone. You know, they have a lower belt. The bellies are always lighter. Virtually everything is in the world, really. Flounders on up, white sharks, everything's got a lighter belly, just like a fly does, because it's not being seen. You know, it's covered. But I find it more important on, say, I'd say 14s and up. But I do think it's relative for sure.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Jay Stout in Woodland Park, Colorado. Says, is it important to match the hatch, or is exploring with some wild and crazy pattern sometimes a better option? When and why would you use each approach?
I generally, there's two sides to that idea, because there's been a lot of fish caught on lightning bugs, and nobody knows what the hell that is. But, you know, so that's kind of the wild and crazy side. But I personally go rather specific to start with. I fish pretty specific on, you know, generally I know what bug I'm after. So I'm not really, you know, I know that the EPORs are going to are hatching today, and so that's what I'm targeting, that nymph, that emerger. And as a sidebar, you're going to see a few hydropsychic caddis. And so, you know, my exploration is generally within the realm of what's truly hatching. Now, given that there's nothing, then yes, I do. I try. But generally, it's associated with something that's naturally in the river. You'll see days when people will throw on something and they go, what the hell does that look like? Well, it's probably a caddis because it's bright and it's green and it's, you know, or something that way. So it's somewhere in shape or form. But personally, I follow what I know is there. And when I'm exploring places I don't know, I'm pretty specific to the hairs there. You know, I keep the basic shapes and sizes. And, you know, I know roughly what's going to be in that river. So I'm more specific. And then, but I can tell you this, when you have estuary fishing, where you have lake fish that migrate, one thing to keep in mind when he said wild and crazy, when Jay said that, I'm thinking he means like something in a bright color as opposed to size. But when I have estuary fish, where I have fish moving in and out of lakes or moving out of lakes because they get too warm to go to rivers, I can generally go to a brighter fly on those fish. And frequently flies, like blue is a color that, you know, we just don't see anything in blue. Reflective blue patterns, like a blue lightning bug. For some reason, you got those fish, they tend towards them. And the other thing would be a bright color whenever you have shrimp of some sort in your system. I think you get away with some pretty crazy colors because we really don't, you know, necessarily know exactly what the fish is seeing anyway. It's funny, I just saw something I was just reading, a friend of mine, Dave Johnson, sent me a thing about what fish see. And this guy's a super genius, and I mean, he's way deeper than me with my room temperature IQ, but everything I've read in the last 20 years say that fish see red is brown at 3 feet, and his study that he just showed me showed that they see red better than any color in the spectrum. So, I mean, everything I've known, you know, because I read it once, is wrong.
Yeah, that is.
I tend towards, to answer the question in a direct way, which I'm not very good at, I tend towards the keeping it to what is in the system.
Mm-hmm. And knowing what the hatches are that's happening at that time.
Roughly, yeah, roughly. Yeah. That's why I said at the beginning, if I had one fly, it would be a hare's ear. Because
there's
two shades, I can cover virtually every mayfly on the planet.
Right, and there's mayflies almost everywhere in every trout stream. So.
Yeah, and if it's caddis, that's why I said, well, then I'd need a caddis larva because, you know, there's only X number of caddis. There's, you know, hundreds of kinds of caddis, but they're larvae and then they pupate. And so it narrows it down.
Yeah.
And
next question was from Joe in Houston, Texas, about what are some good flies to use when high stick nymphing, and I think you kind of addressed that.
Mm-hmm.
You're not using any different flies than you would using other techniques. It's just more a matter of presentation, correct?
Exactly. That's exactly it. And the way I fish them, you know, I'm letting the lead do the work, so I don't have to have a weighted fly. So I'm taking the same fly that anybody else would be fishing. I'm just fishing it in the zones where I think they should be.
Right.
So I'm not fighting myself.
Okay, so let's talk about...
one thing. I hate to interrupt you, but on that nymphing the flies and stuff, one of the most common things that happens is that people think that they can't see flies in dirty water because he's asking, is there special rigs? And that's the only time I can tell you that they still see the fly. I don't care if you can't see 1 inch in that water. That fish can see, and you do not need to go big to catch. I hear it all the time, and I swear to you, if you come here when it's 4,000 CFS, normally we're running 800 to 1,000. You come here at 4,000 with zero visibility, and we're fishing size 18 flies. You do not have to go big. The fish makes a living eating. He can see your fly. He can feel your fly. And trout are tactile eaters, meaning that they don't fish, they don't eat by olfactory, they don't eat by scent. They touch everything. And so even in virtually no clarity, the fish will touch it, and you do not have to go huge. I get people asking all the time for triple tungsten beaded flies. And I love those people. I love them. I sell them a lot of flies. But again, it's just a sidebar. You don't have to go big, and you don't have. And the other thing about that is we were talking about crystal before. If the water's dirty, you do not have to have a flashy fly. I do quite the opposite. I tend to my darker colors, even in the size 18.
I think and I've mentioned this before on shows, but when I interviewed Ralph Cutter, who's done a lot of underwater work,
mm-hmm.
and he said, I think you would probably agree with him, that for him it was all about presentation too, getting that fly in the right place at the right time, and he didn't feel that it was placed a whole lot of importance on what that fly was, because his observation showed that trout are taking in their mouth almost everything that's coming down
their head. Yeah,
they're spitting it back out, of course, but, you know.
And they're tactile eaters. The presentation. They're tactile eaters. They touch everything. In the old days when we actually killed fish and ate them, we all opened up their stomachs. And you found, it's like the movie Jaws, you know. It's like when they're opening that thing. Here comes this. Here comes that. They touched everything. You frequently found sticks because caddis, look like a stick, and they'd eat sticks, they'd eat anything, but back to the presentation, lead fly fly. Now remember what Ralph said, if the fly was there and they touched it and they'd spit it out quickly, that's almost imperceivably quick.
Mm-hmm.
When the fish takes that fly, just like Ralph said, he takes it and he spits it out, right? So the fly that's below the lead and it's coming down, so the fly's 2 foot below the split shot, that fish just sitting there and just takes it. He doesn't move. I said, if he doesn't turn to the side, you won't feel it. He just takes that fly, spits it out faster than you'll never know it happened. When you go to check style fishing or drop shotting, as I do, you virtually feel everything because now your lead's above it and they touch everything. And that's why I said they'll take the wrong fly if it's fished right, but they won't take the right fly if it's fished wrong. If the fly's in the wrong zone, you're not going to get the fish to eat it. And so
now, when you get people coming in for guide service,
mm-hmm.
and you get them out in the boat, and they start rigging themselves up for, weight above the flies,
mm-hmm.
do you try to convert them? I mean,
I do, and I tell people that it's the dumbest thing I've ever done. And I'll make this statement right now, and everybody can challenge it. When you go to drop shotting, and the reason I say it's the dumbest thing I ever did because I'm asking people not to lose 50% of their flies. When you go to drop shotting, you
it hurts
will
the
lose.
Retail.
It's the dumbest thing. My dad would slap me if he was here. He was still alive. But when you go to drop shotting, I tell people, listen, I speak to people every week I do a seminar somewhere, and I tell them you're going to lose 50% less flies immediately. And most people, the minute they do it, hook up 50% more because of that same thing. Instead of relying on the bobber and fly, lead fly fly, and remembering what Jay said, or what Ralph said, Cutter, that they touch everything, and they didn't. He doesn't really think the fly is that critical. And back to the, you know, what we were just talking about, what's your favorite fly, and he said, oh, I keep it basic. It's the same principle. If the fly's in their zone, they touch it. If it's the leads above, upstream of that fly, you're going to feel it, right?
Yeah.
You feel it now all of a sudden. And that's the first thing that happens to people. They go out, they quit losing flies, and they're like, oh, my God. And that's why, you know, I felt so many more fish. You know, boom, boom, oh, my God, there's another fish. And what happens is it's the step down. And that's why we start with the high stick and we have them have the colored line so they can see it. And basically what we do, we start them out with an indicator. But we make you, in the high sticking, I talked about not mending your line, you know, to lead your line. And what happens is people start, we get them to start leading their, almost pulling their indicator. Not, you don't want to pull it, but almost. And what you see is they set the hook and they go, I didn't even see it. No, no, you felt it.
Mm-hmm.
Now you're fishing. And so, like I said, from a retail perspective, it was the dumbest thing I ever did is tell people, because you just quit using flies and you start catching more fish. Well, that doesn't make me as much money as I'm supposed to be making. So,
well,
anyway.
We have to raise the price on the flies then.
Exactly.
You know? There you go.
If you're a drop shotter, they're twice as much.
Yeah, exactly. Bob Silver, New Mexico, asks, what stream conditions are best suited to high stick nymphing and what conditions are more suited to indicator nymphing? Well, we just found out you're going to mix the two up. But
right.
Let's talk about stream conditions.
That you know, the condition means nothing to me. Like I said, my favorite condition highest number days of the year are zero visibility. You can't see an inch in the water. Zero visibility, high water. There's one caveat there is the fact that it pushes all your fish into soft water. So in dirty high conditions, you look for a specific style of water. It's not so much the, you know, anything other than finding break where the fish has enough current coming past them. They prefer to be on that seam where it's slow on one side, fast on the other. And they sit on that seam, but they don't want to fight the huge water. So, you know, that's one condition. And it pushes all your fish over. So that I'd use the same technique there, but I'm looking for a specific water. Now, if you're talking about spring creeks as opposed to, you know, different styles of water, sometimes, you know, super shallow water, and, then things change, you know, you've got to lengthen things up. I think, so much of that has to do with the Hertz wave that the impact of the line does on the water. The splat of that creates a shock wave that the fish feel, and so you end up having to go longer. And what I do personally, and if you in the high, not in the high stick, but in the nymphing by the numbers ones, you'll see that what I call the upstream technique is drop shotting, what we've just been talking about.
Mm-hmm.
And I simply lengthen it a long ways out. And so I can cast upstream in skinny water, still have my lead below my fly so that it's the furthest thing above me, and then the flies come at the fish before the lead does. So that my conditions change, my leader systems change, they're longer, because I might have to cast upstream, but I still have my lead above it. But that's also a place where I might check nymph, where I use a weighted fly, like a bead head, and I'm talking about water less than a foot deep here. And that's in that fast water, you know, like a traditional, like a little spring creek, where I might do that. But that's the only time. I'm not sure I answered his question.
Well, I'm wondering if he was. I mean, all that information was great, but I'm wondering if
indicator fishing.
Well, no, talking about like you know whether you're fishing pools or riffles or you know those kind of conditions
mm-hmm.
in the stream.
But, yeah, that would make sense. And I generally tell people when a bobber to me is a suspension style fishing. I mean, an indicator, excuse me. So when you're indicator fishing, that's suspension fishing where you're allowing the flies to drop in like soft water, not much current. And that's, by the way, that's also how the French, you know, when you see French systems, when they use a piece of monofilament on the butt section that's been coiled. And so you can cast it out there and you can see it move because they can't use indicators, you know, when you're competition. A lot of places you can't. But the difference is like if you're fishing a pool or something where, you really can't get up high above them. You can't, you know, you can't stand there with your rod up in the air because you spooked every fish in the pool out. At which point, you know, of course, a small style like that's also where a hopper dropper comes in pretty handy too, because it's natural on both ends. You know, they see the hopper, you know, they're used to not spooked by the hopper. And I don't think they're spooked by indicators either, personally. I've had 1,000 fish eat indicators. So if they're spooked by them, I'd find all the dumb ones.
Yeah.
I mean, I had one morning where I had 16 fish eat a bobber. And in just one morning, and it was like, are you kidding me? And,
yeah.
But at any rate, if I've got a slow pool and then I'm suspension fishing where I'm just throwing it out and I'm strictly fishing by its visual, because personally I like to have as many indicators as I can. I mean, visual, touch, you know, whatever it takes. But in that case, I think you're better off, you know, suspension fishing to a specific depth and just letting it run through those pools real softly. And a lot of times in small stuff, you aren't going to get the ability to high stick them.
Yeah, that's what I was just going to say. When we're talking high sticking, in general, we're talking that you really don't have any line on the water. And
not much, no.
Yeah, and so that kind of limits where you can fish, at least distance-wise from where you're standing. Whereas when you're suspension fishing, you can fish water that you couldn't get to high sticking, and that
yeah.
might be the only way you can fish that water. Scenario.
And given that's your only opportunity, you got to give it a shot
mm-hmm.
for sure. I mean, you've got to fish all the water. But what you'll see most people find is that the fish will allow you so much closer than you think they will. I mean, given that it's a stealthy approach. Now, you're talking about a 6-foot wide high mountain spring creek or Minnesota spring creek or whatever here. Obviously, you're not going to be able to stand there and high stick them, but you can sneak up behind them and keep your line off the water. You just have to be stealthy and tactful. You know, not any one's going to be perfect for every situation.
Right.
You know, and that's the beauty of it, really, is that you get to adapt. I mean, I basically teach 4 different systems as far as setups and then as your leader configurations and things like that. And then you've got basic indicator fishing, and then you've got, drop shotting or checking, whichever you want to call it. And, you know, one's good for one thing. For example, drop shotting's not perfect from a boat either. I mean, check nymphing from a boat isn't as efficient as it is on foot.
Mm-hmm.
So, because you've got, you know, you can cast from the boat and, you know, you can drop a bobber over there and fish a seam from the boat, but it's mostly mechanical advantage from your angle. That's the big thing.
Yeah.
Now, I personally don't like to, you know, I like to be on foot when I'm nymphing. I'll do it from a boat, but I would prefer to be, but, you know, that's a real popular style of fishing. I mean,
it's easier from the boat, too, because your boat's moving with the water, too, so it's easier
yeah.
to maintain the drift, especially for newbies on the water. And,
sure.
I think that's probably one of the easier ways.
The unfortunate thing of that is people get into that mode and then they don't digress. They don't get out of that mode.
Yeah.
And so what we've created, and a lot of it has to do with guiding. You know, I'm guilty of it. Everybody's guided. You do what's easiest on the client and then catches them the most fish.
Right.
And so they don't necessarily stop and say, hey, let's try this.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
broad base and teach. But, you know, the system presentation, for me personally, that's what it's all about. In my seminars, I tell people that the most critical part of nymph fishing, because I think it's the hardest way to fish there is. Most people say, oh, it's anybody can do it. And that's not true at all. Anybody can throw a dry fly to a dry fly fish, to a rising fish, you can see everything.
Uh-huh.
But now you've got to visualize everything underwater.
Yeah.
And you can, yeah. and drag is just as critical underwater as it is on the surface. So it's challenging. It makes it really, I mean, I think it's a blast. You get to learn something every day.
Here's a question from Chuck in Santa Rosa, California. It says, when high stick nymphing, what are the limits in terms of how shallow or how deep the water? What are the limits in terms of how far out of the river one can effectively fish? That's kind of what we're
that
doing.
That is a great question. Okay, kind of back to what I was just saying. I like to fish. I say this in all my seminars. Just because you can cast to it doesn't mean you can fish it. That being said, if it's my only option, I'm going to do it. But when you start pinpointing your fish and vision, that's what I tell people more than anything. I want you to visualize not only the fish and your flies. I like people to visualize exactly the fish's head, because I want you to fish very well the fish's head. I don't want you to fish a 10-foot drift. I want you to be set up across from your fish, slightly up or down one way or the other, but I want you to think you can see that fish's face open up and eat your fly. I want you to know that you're going to be fishing a 6-inch window, not a 7-foot, 10-foot run. Because then you're kind of hoping. Once you start specifically saying, I'm fishing to that fish, you can't see it, you got to visualize it, you'll be in complete control right there. Now, what does that mean to how far you can fish away from you? 15 feet away from you, double seams, triple seams between you. Can you high stick out there? Can you visualize where the fish is? Can you get complete control of your fly? If you can, hallelujah, then you can fish it. But I've always said, just because you can cast to it. Now, if you're fishing bobbers, if you're fishing indicators, and you can throw it out there, still can maintain control over your drift, not get the current pulling your line down. It really doesn't do you any good just to throw out there and never get a decent drift. You might luck into one now and then, but you're not really fishing. So for me personally, I would say 90% of the time, 15 foot would be my maximum distance away from me. I mean, basically. You know, like to visualize it, see it, get control over it, and then move to the fish as opposed to casting to the fish.
About depth, you were saying before that most of the insect activity is, what, 4 feet or less? So
yeah, generally speaking. I mean, you'll find areas where you'll have, and even when you've got big hex areas and things like that, and we say, well, you know, these are big mud burrowers, those fish, those flies are even shallower. Those fish are really skinny. It all has to do with light penetration. And in really deep water, you have almost no light penetration past, because there's detriments in that water. There's all kinds of things that block light before it gets down there. And so you very seldom find aquatic life down at 5 feet. I mean, everybody will say, I've caught so many fish in, you know, 5 foot of this. Okay, great. But the biomass isn't there. And so the numbers of fish aren't there because you don't have the food to keep them there.
Right.
And when a fish is set up in water where he's not eating actively, he's not a good target. You need to find the fish that are actively feeding. That's why you have two flies on. You're trying to establish which water they're in. And you think, you know, there's bugs moving. So you just kind of lose it when you get into those deeper runs.
Yep.
But, you know, as a whole, there's always an exception, but as a whole, you're going to find most of your fish in 5 foot or most of your aquatic life in 5 foot or less. And for most waters, it's going to be 4 foot or less.
Right. Steve Perry in Colorado Springs wrote in, and this is kind of addressed something you were talking about before, so I want to get some clarification. I think his question will probably do that. He says, I'm more of a feel-type high sticker, but understand many people prefer looking for leader movement. Can you give me your 2 cents on advantages and disadvantages of the two? Did you describe before that you're kind of using both with your colored?
Well, you know, I tried to. The color thing is just for that moment that I lose. Like, for the example, I'm throwing upstream, and I don't have the I want as many communication tools as possible. I want to feel, I want to see. So the gold strand, if say I'm fishing in the 4 foot run, and I'm having trouble, I'm getting my lines getting pushed around, I'm not touching as much as I want to, I can see it also. So, but I tend to be much more of a feel than visual. And when he said the leader movement, I don't really necessarily buy into that. I mean, if the flies are where the flies belong, I don't want it moving around. I want it right where I'm telling it to be. And so I tend to be, with the style that I use, with a drop shot style, or even for that matter, if it's between the flies, The one thing that you need to understand about, I think the most important part of nymphing well, is that the lead, as opposed to when he said the leader moving, he tends to be more of a field guy, which is basically me as well. I mean, I do the same thing. But the movement of the line is what the leader movement is what he's saying, where people are, and it's called naked nymphing. It's where you don't have any indication at all. You watch your leader move. And that's fine. I mean, it's another stage, but I tend to be more in the field because back to the setup. My setup, the drop shot setup that I was talking about, the critical thing to this is because people walk into my shop every day and say, I'm on the Madison's giant freestoner and it goes from, raging white water to flat pools down below. And they'll say, how much split shot do I need? And that question cannot be answered. But the key to this is that the first thing you do is you establish that the split shot is on bottom always. And what the split shot becomes is it's your primary communication tool to tell you that you're on bottom. It becomes your baseline, your constant. It's the thing that says you're always on bottom, and now you know exactly where your flies are because you position your flies above it.
But and you're not getting hooked up.
Yeah, and you always, the difference between a great day and a bad day nymphing of any system is generally about 6 inches in the water column. You're touching bottom and you know that, it's your constant. Your flies can vary the way you want them to, but you touch bottom every single time, right? And you don't drag, you just touch. It tells you where you belong. So now you're a field guy, like Steve said, that he's kind of a field guy. But if it's deeper and you know you're touching bottom, you can also watch your line. So now you got double communication tools. It's telling you if you don't feel it, you still see your line straighten. And that's why we use the gold strand or we make them up out of amnesia where we have two different, the green, red, green, we have three colors. And so you can see it. So it's kind of both. What Steve's asking, he said, I'm a field guy, me too. But if it drops off for whatever reason, say it goes from 2 foot, you've been fishing 2 foot, one BB shot's getting you there. Then you get a little bucket where it drops into 2.5 to 3 feet. Well, the lead can't get there quick enough. The fish are still in that zone. Now you see your leader tighten up. Now you got a double communication tool. That's why I use the yellow strand or the amnesia or whatever.
Yeah, it all makes really good sense what you've said tonight. And when you think about it, a lot of the methods that we fish, we have so many pieces and parts in between us and that fish in the take. It's a wonder we ever catch anything. I mean, slack line on the water, an indicator, lead above the flies, and those are all failure points. Now that I see.
And that's why people are talking about Euro, and it all has to competition. It all goes back to us going to competition fishing, and we kept getting our butts kicked over in Europe. And the European guys were used to remember I was talking about, the French team, well, they've got an advantage in of itself. I think the shortest guy on the team is 6'5". So there, he's already got a foot mechanical advantage over most people. But the thing was, is that they weren't reliant on systems that had faults built into them. Checking, whenever you have the weight at the bottom end, it means that you've got to do more of the feel, but you still have visual. So they tried eliminating as many as possible. And by doing so with that, what I do with the drop shot, and by the way, the Europeans didn't invent this. We were drop shotting in this country. Oh, they may have done it over there too, but we were doing it with lead, with the fly low like that 80 years ago. I mean, drop shotting, it comes from bass fishing. It's a style of fishing a worm, but the idea is that the weight's on the bottom. Yeah. But the Europeans were so effective at that because they weren't reliant on seeing a bobber move because they can't use them.
Yeah.
And they weren't using lead, so they didn't have the option to put the lead above the flies. They didn't have inherent built-in problems. They had to have the lead be the heaviest thing, and it had to be on the end of the line. So they immediately became more effective at feeling and seeing the fly. And what happened here is that we got pretty much dependent on visual-only fishing. So if the bobber didn't go under or go sideways, nobody knew they had a fish.
We ran out of time, but there were two questions looking for clarification here. It might be the same issue. Let me read them both to you, Kelly, and then you can kind of straighten this out. Jim in Centennial says, please ask Kelly to describe his dropper loop again. He said it was basically perfection loop. Additional discussion would be great. And then Paul in Roseburg says, drop shot sliding knot again, please. So are we talking about the same issue here, that they want more clarification?
Yep.
Okay.
Yep.
Can you do that real quick?
I can. And, again, I'll post that up on my website if anybody wants it. The dropper loop, this is the first thing, the most important thing, is it has to be above a blood knot. Something has to stop it from going down the line further. So it's above a blood knot. It's generally a 4-inch, what I like, is a 4-inch loop. So I try to keep I do a perfection loop, you know, or whatever. If you'd like to do a double surgeon's loop, whatever loop, the knot you can tie well. And I like that to be about a 1/2 inch long. Now, there's people out there right now saying, well, can't you just use the tag end of your blood knot or your double surgeon's? Yes, you can, but what the problem with that is, as you start changing flies, suddenly you've got to change your whole rig because you've got to do no blood knot. With this system, you put the loop above it. So the loop is above the blood knot, and you put it on the back side of the line. You thread the other end through the loop, and you just tighten it down. And so now it's a sliding dropper. And so it bumps into it's 4 inches long, and because you have a loop, it's doubled up right by the leader, so it keeps it off away from your line a little bit, too.
Uh-huh.
But it's just simply a small loop. It's got a loop in one end, and then, you know, 4 inches of line hanging off of it. You thread it through itself and tighten it around the leader. Then it stops by hitting the blood knot.
Blood knot, yeah. Okay, good.
And I'll post that up tomorrow just so people can see it.
Okay, great. Again, that's slidein.com, folks, Kelly site. Well, we've got to wrap it up here. We do have a few things to give away. I'm sorry, folks, we didn't get all the questions answered. I mean, we had a ton of questions tonight, all great questions, but I think if we all listened carefully tonight, we learned a whole lot about nymphing. So I think it was a great show. Stick with me here. We're going to give away a 1-year subscription of Federation of Fly Fishers, membership, I should say, and a subscription to Fly Fishing and Tying Journal. And we're going to be giving away a copy of Kelly's DVD, High Sticking and Reading Water, which was produced by Flyfish TV, flyfishtv.com. So stick with me here just a minute, and we'll give those gifts away. Family Ties, that's T-Y-E-S. Family Ties is an organization which uses a shared interest in fly fishing and fly tying to enhance youth development and family relationships. They utilize resources in schools, communities, and businesses, and they invite your participation. Go to their website, www.familyties.com. That's family, T-Y-E-S.com. Family Ties, where every fish is a trophy and every kid is a hero. Just a quick reminder to everyone before you leave the website tonight, please take a minute and give us your feedback about the show. You can find a link on our homepage in the section under tonight's show that said, what did you think of this show? Just click on the link and leave your comments, and we'd really appreciate it. Now it's time to give away our prizes. Winners of our drawings are randomly selected from the show's registration database. If you didn't register yet for tonight's show, it's too late, but make sure you do so for the next show, and then you will have a chance at some great prizes we give away. If you are the lucky winner, we'll contact you after the show to provide you with information on how to receive your gifts. So first, we're going to give away a 1-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers. And to learn more about the Federation, go to fedflyfishers.org, fedflyfishers.org. And I know you'll enjoy seeing what they're up to and becoming a member if you don't win tonight. So let me see here, get into my database, select. It looks like our winner for that is Benjamin True, Benjamin True in Pennsylvania. So Ben or Benjamin, congratulations, and you just won yourself a 1-year membership to the Federation. And next is a 1-year subscription to Fly Fishing and Tying Journal. And you can learn more about that at AmatoBooks.com. And you can also see a lot of the other books that they've published there in periodicals. So our winner for that is Dale Bear in Montana. Dale, congratulations on winning that subscription as well. Now, I'll pose a question, or probably a two-part question here, and see if anybody can answer it and win the DVD, Kelly's DVD from Fly Fish TV tonight. Let's see here. This will probably be... Okay, two-part question. What's the fly Kelly cannot, you know, if he had one fly, what would it be? And what's his method of waiting? Okay, two-part question. First one with the right answer wins. Let's see here. What's wrong with my thing?
Not even sure. I know that answer.
Okay.
It's a trick question, isn't it?
Yeah. It's a trick question. You're not sure you know the answer. let's see here. I don't know. Something that I'm not getting things through here. All right. Okay. Here they come. Here they come. There must have been some delay in my internet connection. Looks like I've got one here. Hare's Ear and Drop Shot.
Dead on.
Dead on. That's Bill Hefner in Nazareth. Nazareth, I don't know where Nazareth is, but Bill Hefner. You just got yourself a DVD from Fly Fish TV, and you can watch Kelly do all the things we were talking about tonight. But actually, I think you gave quite a bit of depth into, you know, with the DVD and what we've got tonight. Boy, you know, people will be set to go. So thanks,
great.
Kelly, for sharing your information tonight. And, oh, by the way, Bill, please send me your address in the same box you just sent your answer in, and that will get to me, and then we can get you that DVD sent out. But, Kelly, thanks for being online again tonight. I know you had kind of a tough timing problem there tonight to get on the phone, but I appreciate your efforts, and and all's well, so that's good. And stay warm up there, and thanks for being on, and hopefully we'll have you again sometime.
Well, thank you, Roger. I appreciate it.
Yeah, let me know when that new book comes out. Maybe we can time a show around that. So
I would love it.
Okay, yeah. Sounds good. Our next broadcast will be on March 5th, 7 p.m. Mountain, 9 p.m. Eastern, and on that show I'm going to interview Steve Perry. And our topic for the show will be Project Healing Waters. Steve is the program lead in Colorado Springs, Colorado, for Project Healing Waters, and his program has been rated the top program in the country. So listen in to learn about Project Healing Waters, how it started, how it works, how it helps, and how you can help. We would also like to thank the Federation of Fly Fishers, Amato Books, Fly Fish TV, Front Range Anglers, Housatonic Outfitters, and for sponsoring our show tonight. And if you think your company would benefit from sponsoring one of our shows, give us a call at 1-800-985-1673, extension 8. That's 800-985-1673, extension 8. We'll be happy to explain the options available to you. Don't forget to visit our website, askaboutflyfishing.com. Make sure you're signed up to receive our announcements so you won't miss out on any of our future broadcasts. Thanks for listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We hope you enjoyed the show. That's it. Good night, everyone, and good fishing.